Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane will be back on Wednesday. President Obama last week announced a new administration initiative aimed at doubling U.S. exports over the next 5 years. Skeptics question whether he'll be able to meet that goal, and China's premier on Sunday had some tough words in response. Joining me in the studio to discuss the president's new national export initiative is Robert Hormats. He is the Undersecretary of State for Economic, Energy, and Agricultural Affairs and a member of the president's new export promotion cabinet. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Great to be back with you. Thanks.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. So the president set a goal of doubling U.S. exports in 5 years. Some people say that is not a realistic goal.
Well, we're certainly going to give it a try. It's important because if you look at exports, they're a larger and larger portion of American GDP. And for many companies and for people who work for those companies, whether they can export successfully is really going to be a key determinant of their economic success, of their ability to create jobs. So if you look at the world, 95% of the world's consumers live outside of the United States. Consumption in the developing countries taken together is greater than consumption in the United States in dollar terms. So we have a big stake in supporting American companies that want to export, big companies and small companies, and a lot of jobs, a lot of wages are dependent on a successful export program, and that's really why it's very important that we undertake this, and that's why the president took this initiative.
So what specifically can the administration do to promote exports?
We can do a lot of things. We can provide additional export financing, which the Export-Import Bank is going to do. We can provide strong advocacy for American companies trying to sell goods abroad through our embassies. We can provide advice at home through the Commerce Department, the Small Business Administration, and other agencies on how companies should go about exporting. A lot of small companies and medium-sized companies have very good products but are not familiar with exporting and not familiar with a number of foreign markets, so we can help them at home to become more familiar. We can have our ambassadors from various parts of the world, when they come back to the United States, meet with companies, meet with businesses, particularly small businesses, and help them to understand the kinds of programs that are available to them in other countries through the embassies. That can be very helpful. We can do a number of things to identify barriers to American goods abroad. And Ron Kirk, our U.S. trade representative, has been very active in doing that and pushing that, and we're going to be doing that in a very assertive way also. All those things can be extremely helpful.
We have our biggest trade imbalance with China, and the president last week singled out China's currency policy as a problem. That got a strong response yesterday from the Chinese premier at his annual news conference. I guess he only has one news conference a year, and it was yesterday. He referred to the administration's effort to push on currency matters as a kind of protectionism. What would you say to that?
Well, I think it probably wouldn't be productive to get into a debate with a premier of China on this show, but I would say this. I think the United States and other countries as well, when they look at the global economy, there has been a big imbalance. A lot of companies and a lot of countries in other parts of the world, China is certainly one of them, have depended very heavily on the American consumer. Well, the American consumer was buying a lot based on a credit bubble, and American consumers now are becoming much more cautious. They're now saving more, borrowing less. So countries that depended on the American consumer to continue to sell more and more of their goods are not going to be able to do that to the same degree. Therefore, they really have to find ways of offsetting the decline in their sales to the American consumer with a greater emphasis on domestic demand, be that consumption or investment. And they have to look at their policies in that context. If they want to continue to grow and they can't grow as much dependent on the American consumer, they have to do a number of things internally, which means they have to rebalance. They have to rebalance internally to depend less on exports and more on their domestic economies. And I think China understands that, and they need to look at their currency policy and their domestic policies in that context.
Well, now, the specific U.S. complaint is that China's keeping its currency artificially low, which gives it a big advantage on the world market. It makes its goods cheaper for Americans and others to buy. So, the Chinese leader did not sound particularly willing to change that, to work on the value of its currency. So what could the U.S. do beyond saying that we're unhappy about that?
Well, Secretary Geithner has had a very effective, I think, relationship with his counterparts in China discussing this. And I think I'll leave it to the Treasury to work on this topic. There's a well-known rule in the U.S. government, which is that the Treasury deals with exchange rate issues and not the State Department. So he is quite on top of this issue. The president has certainly made this point, and I'm sure there'll be additional conversations between the Treasury and the Chinese government on this issue. But it needs to be, as I said, part of the Chinese looking at how they want to grow in the future and find ways of depending less on exports and more on domestic consumption, domestic investment, because the American consumer just can't sustain the kind of demand that he or she has been able to sustain over the future. That means these countries have to look elsewhere if they want to grow. And the rebalancing that we want internationally really is part of a rebalancing that these countries should be doing domestically to reduce export dependence.
Our phone lines are open. You can give us a call at 1-800-433-8850. Now, you've been working on these issues for a very long time, back to the Nixon administration when you were an economic aide at the National Security Council. How different is it now when you think about this global economy from the time that you began to deal with these issues?
It's very different. I was just out of graduate school. I was working on the National Security Council staff as Henry Kissinger's junior economic advisor at the time. And the big difference then was, first of all, there were very few countries that were really driving the global economy. It was a few large industrialized economies. Now you have a multipolar economic world. A new economic geography has supplanted the old one. And that is an economic geography which depends more and more on China, India, Brazil, Russia, South Korea, Saudi Arabia, South Africa. These are all important players in the global economy. You can't really envisage dealing with any major problem or solving any major problem in the world today without the participation of those new economies, as of course, along with some of the more traditional ones. Trade issues depend on working with these countries. Financial issues. These countries were very helpful in many cases in dealing with the financial crisis. Environmental issues, dealing with global pandemics. There are a whole range of issues where these countries need to play a greater role, and we have to change the global architecture in order to incorporate these countries, both to give them more opportunities in the global system, which they obviously want, but also to ensure that they assume responsibility for the global system, because increasingly what they do at home has an impact on the global system, and in turn what happens in the global system increasingly has an impact on their economies. We're one big networked world, and these countries are benefiting more from the system. They have to assume greater responsibility. We can't wave our finger at them and dictate what they do, but we can engage in a very active dialogue so that we all assume a greater responsibility, and we avoid the notion that it's a zero-sum competition. I win, you lose, you win, I lose. If we deteriorate into that on commodities, on trade, on energy, the system is going to deteriorate itself.
I wonder, though, given this more complicated, more interrelated system, if a presidential initiative on exports can have much effect, or is growing the American exports really a function of having the world economy recover and grow?
Well, that is certainly important, absolutely. I think that the key to our ability to export more is really growth in the global economy. Without growth in the global economy, it's very hard to have a robust export picture for any country, and you're swimming upstream because obviously a weak global economy makes it hard to export. But if you assume that the world economy is going to come out of its downturn, that would be very helpful. But even given the fact that the global economy in some parts, for instance, Western Europe, is relatively weak, even assuming that, we can enable a lot of very competitive American companies that have not been able to export as much as they possibly could, help them to do that. There are a lot of companies that are very competitive. The American worker is still very productive, very competitive, very innovative, a lot of innovative companies. We can help them, even in the current context, to sell their goods in foreign markets with the kinds of assistance and financing and support that I mentioned at the outset.
What about the issue of free trade agreements? There are several of them that are kind of, they've been in the works, that are stalled in the Senate. This is a tough economic climate to get movement on them, isn't it?
Absolutely it is. And Americans over the last several years have become somewhat skeptical about some of these free trade agreements. Although there are many, many very positive aspects of those agreements, the ones that are pending with Panama, with Colombia, and with South Korea. We're working on those now with these other countries, working with the Congress. And the president, as he indicated in his speech, would like at some point to move forward on those agreements. But we're trying to make adjustments now to enable us to do this. The other point he made that was very important is we can't sit on the sidelines. When we don't do anything, other countries are moving ahead. There are huge numbers of free trade agreements that are being reached throughout the world. In East Asia alone, the fastest growing area of the world economically, there are about 105 free trade agreements that have been agreed upon over the last several years. We're a party to only four of them. To the extent that other countries make free trade agreements with one another, we have our market share sliced down because they get better access to one another's markets. We don't get that kind of access. It's adverse to our economic and our trade interests. So we want to get into this game. We're negotiating with a number of Asians on something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and we think there are opportunities in the future.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Robert Hormats about efforts to increase U.S. exports. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Robert Hormats. He's Undersecretary of State for Economic, Energy, and Agricultural Affairs. And we've been talking about the administration's new initiative to increase U.S. exports. The administration wants to double them within the next 5 years. We're going to go to the phones and take some of your calls and questions. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. We'll go first to Champ. He's calling us from Statesville, North Carolina. Champ, hi, you're on the air.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I just wanted to make a comment. You know, we have had a jobs recession, and anybody that's paying attention can see what effect, you know, Chinese trade policy has had on that. And, you know, it's just amazing that nobody's talking about, you know, the policies that we have. You know, federal tax policy is sending jobs overseas. The biggest tax in the land is payroll taxes, which are 41% of what the government creates. You know, if you're a U.S. manufacturer, which I am, that figures into the cost of the goods that I produce. And, you know, my products compete in the marketplace with products coming from Asian countries. You know, the government doesn't collect any money on it. And, you know, it taxes my goods and doesn't tax those goods.
And, Champ, let me ask you, what kind of product do you make?
My company's been in business since 1924. We manufacture rocking chairs.
Huh.
And last year we bought the company that made the Kennedy rocker and chairs and rocking chairs.
And Champ, how much of your business is outside the United States in terms of sales? Champ? I think we lost Champ. Robert Hormats.
Well, Champ's got a very interesting point. Obviously, taxes are a cost factor for American companies in their ability to compete with other countries. But the offsetting that or helping to mitigate that is the fact that American companies and American workers are very productive. And one of the things that we are optimistic about is that the productive capacity, the innovative capacity of American companies can enable them with the kind of assistance that the government is going to provide, the kind that I've mentioned a little while ago, to do very well. For instance, it'd be interesting to see how much of his products are exported. My guess is almost certainly that a lot of American companies, small companies that the kind Champ owns, can do better at exporting. Most American companies, to the extent they export at all, export to maybe one or two countries, primarily Canada and Mexico because of proximity. But we think a lot of American companies are capable of exporting to a lot of other countries, and we want to help them. Karen Mills, for instance, who's the head of the Small Business Administration, and I have been working very closely together to mobilize the enormous strengths that the Small Business Administration has domestically with the enormous strengths that the State Department has internationally to help small businesses do the kind of things that Champ has indicated, which is to export more, and that will help create jobs. But it is a very competitive world. There's no question about that. Taxes are only one part of it. A lot of companies around the world are very competitive for a whole range of reasons, lower wages in some cases. In some cases, they have skills that are particularly related to their sector. So there are a lot of reasons for that competition is very intense. But the one is certainly that you've got, since the end of the Cold War, hundreds of millions of new workers part of the global economy that they weren't before. So that makes the world more competitive, too.
Let's go to Kristen. She's calling us from Slade, Kentucky. Kristen, thanks for holding on.
Oh, thanks so much for taking my call. I'm a big fan of the show. My question pertains specifically to biotech companies. I work with some of them, and they have pretty innovative products that they're interested in selling overseas, but they do have the problem where some countries do not honor intellectual property or patent law and will simply steal the idea for the product to sell domestically. And I'm wondering what specifically the U.S. government has done or what they can do to try to make a more global environment for honoring patent law as it exists in different countries.
Kristen, you have put your finger on one of the biggest single problems we face in the world today, and I appreciate your raising it. There are a lot of very, very innovative American companies in the biotech area and other areas, and that is really key to our future growth. Knowledge industries that are growing because people have been innovative, entrepreneurial, come up with new ideas, and those companies create high-quality new jobs in new sectors. And you're absolutely right. Around the world, there is a huge problem, and the problem is that countries and companies either pirate American intellectual property, or in some cases, companies are forced to hand over intellectual property as a condition for doing business in countries. China, for instance, has a policy which is known as indigenous innovation, which is very harmful to American innovative companies and aims to provide preferences or benefits for Chinese companies. And in some cases, China forces American companies to transfer technology as a precondition for doing business. And sometimes they end up in the hands of Chinese companies. This is a serious problem. The United States is working very hard on this. The U.S. Trade Representative is working on it, Commerce Department, the State Department. We have in the White House an individual who is working very hard as sort of a focal point in trying to deal with counterfeit goods and trying to deal with other issues relating to intellectual property. Just last week, I was out in California and talked to the Motion Picture Association and a group of people they'd assembled. You're finding a lot of piracy in that area, of piracy of software. So these are very important issues that we are taking very seriously because they affect companies like yours, because they affect the future innovative capacities of the United States, and because if we're going to be successful in the future, it is these innovative companies like yours that are going to be the key element of that success, and we do not want other countries or companies in those countries to pursue policies that undermine that potential.
But say you have a situation where people in India, for instance, are pirating DVDs of movies and selling them and not honoring the intellectual property rights. What can the U.S. government do about that to control it?
Yes, it's not just China. China has issues. We're working with the Chinese government. There are some very good opportunities to work with the Chinese government, as with the Indian government. There are certain things we can do. We can toughen up on people who bring in pirated software, for instance, or pirated DVDs into the United States. We can work with other countries to strengthen their capacity to police their own industries and deal with pirated property. In fact, in China, in some cases, the government has raided certain companies and certain factories and seized pirated property. So it's not a universal problem in China, but it is fairly extensive in certain parts of that economy. And there are certain policies that we want and would like the Chinese to change. And we do it because in many of these countries, they have their own intellectual property. The Chinese have a very thriving intellectual property business. There are some very innovative companies, the same in India. And in India, they've cut down a substantial amount on some kind of piracy because many of their companies are very innovative, and they want their government to protect them. The same is, I hope, going to become more prevalent in China. When the Chinese develop more of their intellectual property at home, they'll want more intellectual property protection from their government. But there are a number of conventions. There's the World Intellectual Property Organization that is designed to protect intellectual property. There are many groups within the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development discussing this. There are various rules in American law where we put countries that are notorious violators on a special list, and there are certain penalties for being on that list. There are a whole range of things in the World Trade Organization where we can go after countries that do this. We're really launching a full court press here because of just the reasons Kristen mentioned. This is important to her company and important to our overall economy.
You know, you were as a young aide in the Nixon administration working on the diplomatic outreach to China, which was such a breakthrough at that point. Did policymakers at that point envision that China would be such an economic powerhouse to be dealt with just a few decades later?
Almost no one I know ever imagined that China would be as much of an economic powerhouse as it is today. And you know, in one sense, the strong Chinese economy can be of benefit to the U.S. because it is a big market for a lot of American products. And we welcome China's purchase of American products. It's also a big market for East Asian products. And to the extent East Asians can sell more to China, they also buy more from the United States. So it helps there. We want to work with the Chinese. We work very closely with them in dealing with the international financial crisis. We've worked very closely with them in dealing with a number of other issues. Our goal is not to have a confrontation with the Chinese over this issue. Our goal is to help them understand that they have an interest in protecting intellectual property and doing a number of other things in a responsible way, not because we tell them to. We can't go around wagging our finger and lecturing them, but we can say it is in your long-term interest to work with us on these global economic issues, intellectual property being one, because it helps in the long run your own people. So no one ever envisaged in the 1970s when I was going there, when China was a very poor economy, that that it would grow the way it has and become a major financial and a major commercial power. We also shouldn't forget the Chinese do have a somewhat different agenda. One of the ironies of our system is that the big countries that run the system today are different from those in the past. In the past, the big countries that ran the system were rich countries with very high GDPs per capita. Today, you have India, China, Brazil, and others that are big economies, but also have a lot of very poor people. So their agenda is different from ours, but they still have a responsibility for the global system, because the better the global system works, the better it will be for them.
You know, one example of that would be the G7 meetings, the meetings of the big industrialized powers, which I know you worked on when they first got started. This is not that, at that point, that was a group that could have a lot of sway in determining what was happening in the world economy. That group, that membership of that group has really enlarged now, of the economies that you really have to pay attention to.
Exactly. The G7 was the sort of board of directors of the global economy for about 30 years. Now we have the group of 20, and that is very important because it demonstrates that you can't just manage the global economy with a few large industrialized democracies. You have to expand participation, and the countries that are now to the board of the global economy are these big emerging economies, plus some of the more traditional economies. But you need these economies to make the global system work.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, and we're going to read your emails. We're going to go first to Alabama, though, to Birmingham, and talk to Mike. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Fine, thank you.
I was wondering, is there anything that can be done to either bring back or keep manufacturing jobs in America? I saw a report the other day where the average Chinese worker makes 89 cents an hour, whereas the average American worker makes almost $30 an hour. And it just seems so out of kilter to me.
All right, Mike, thanks for your call. How about these, you know, those good manufacturing jobs, like in the auto industry that used to enable workers without much education beyond high school to earn a middle-class wage? Is there any way to bring those jobs back to the United States?
Well, I think some of them, the change in the American economy is in part the result of technological change in this country. Companies are just more productive. They use technology better, and in some cases, technology replaces workers. That is part of the technological change we face. You can make more products with fewer people using new technologies, robotics and such things. There's also global competition, which this gentleman has talked about from China. The difference is that in some cases, while these workers are paid a lot less, they're also not as productive of American workers. So to some degree, that wage differential is offset. But he's quite right. The American industrial sector is under a lot of pressure from abroad. Now, what can we do to help avoid a loss of jobs or strengthen the job picture in the manufacturing sector? In some cases, some of those jobs inevitably will be lost. In other cases, there are ways of strengthening the capacity to produce manufactured goods in this country competitively and sell them abroad. One of the reasons we want to do this export initiative is so that manufacturing companies that do have competitive products can sell more abroad and therefore increase job production. Another is better worker training, so that workers who lose their jobs in one area will get adjustment assistance and perhaps be able, with that assistance, get jobs in another area. On lifetime training to help people to increase their capabilities, their education, to train themselves for better careers or new careers, or even to do the same job better with new training, also are going to be helpful. So education is really critical to this. We're definitely in a very competitive world, and this gentleman's right to be concerned about manufacturing jobs, but we cannot take this lying down. We have to do a number of things internally to make ourselves more competitive, and certainly we want to strengthen the manufacturing sector and support competitive jobs in that sector. Not going to be easy, but it's a challenge. We cannot let the manufacturing sector deteriorate. We have to be strong and be effective and be smart in the way we support it.
Now, the president announced this new export promotion cabinet last week. He also relaunched the president's export council. What does that do, and who did he appoint to lead that?
The chairman of Boeing is going to be the leader of it. But it is a very valuable instrument because we want to be able to work with American companies. As you see, the Department of Commerce is now working with FedEx and UPS and other companies in sort of a strategic partnership. The president's, the advisory council of the president is now reinvigorating, is going to be helpful because we want advice from American companies in how they what the government can do to support their exports. A few weeks ago, I chaired and members other members of the administration participated in a very effective dialogue. We had a number of the associations, the trade associations in Washington, meet with us one day representing larger companies, and then one group specifically representing smaller and medium-sized companies. We identified, I'd say, 10 or 15 things that the companies think we can do, we the government can do, to help them export better. And we're going to be pursuing each one of those to the extent we can to make it a success.
Robert Hormats is Under Secretary of State for Economic, Energy, and Agricultural Affairs. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll go back to the phones and take your questions, and we'll read some of your emails. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmal, supporting New Futures, a D.C.-based organization committed to transforming lives through learning. By the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, legal correspondent Jeffrey Toobin explains the inner workings of our nation's highest court, who writes opinions and why, what the Supreme Court has to do with the future of gun control, and the implications of the expected retirement of Justice Stevens. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
We have an email from Andy, who writes us from Indianapolis. He says he owns an export management company and has been helping firms export for 20 years. And he writes, your guest mentions the U.S. has been party to only three or four trade agreements in the past 4 years. Yet he needs to remember there have been free trade agreements with South Korea and Colombia ready for implementation for years now, held up by the union-backed Democratic Congress. So how big a factor has opposition by big labor been to getting some of these free trade agreements through the Senate?
Well, these agreements were negotiated in the last administration. And when the new administration, the Obama administration, came in, understandably, the president wanted us to take a new look at these. And we identified a number of areas where we thought some improvements could be realized in the interest of the United States. We clearly get inputs from the labor movement, and we value those. But we get inputs from businesses. We get inputs from a lot of sectors of the economy. And we try to factor all those into our thinking when we take a look at these agreements. And we obviously we want agreements that are going to pass the Congress. These are agreements that require approval on the Hill. So we want to find ways that we can bring enough domestic constituencies on board and also get support from a majority in the Congress to get these things through. So these are the criteria we have to use in order to evaluate the agreement itself, and particularly the ability to get it through the Congress. That is critical. There's no point in sending an agreement up if you can't get support for it on the Hill, and that's what we're trying to do.
Now, Charlie Rangel, who's been chairman of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee, has stepped down. He's been replaced by Michigan Democrat Sandy Levin, who's chaired the trade subcommittee, is known to be someone who's very engaged and knowledgeable about trade. Does having Levin as the new chairman of Ways and Means create any opportunities for breaking the log jams that prevented some of these deals from going through?
Well, I have Charlie Rangel I've known for a number of years because I lived in New York for 25 years, so I saw a lot of Charlie Rangel and have a lot of respect for his knowledge of these trade issues. Sandy Levin I've known for a very long time and have a lot of respect for Sandy. He is very knowledgeable about these issues, and I have a lot of respect for his thinking and for his points of view. We just talked on the phone a few days ago about a number of these issues, so clearly we want to stay in touch with Chairman Levin. There are a wide range of issues that relate to trade, and he's going to be at the center of them. So we take his views very seriously, and we think there are opportunities. He's a very smart guy. He knows this stuff well. He's very experienced, and our hope, indeed our expectation, is we can work with him. He has strong views, and we want to try to be as responsive as we can to those views. But I look forward to working with him on these issues.
Is he likely to put give a higher priority to these trade deals?
I don't know whether he'll give a higher priority to them. I can tell you he's certainly focused on them. And my hope is that we will continue to have a very positive dialogue as we have had in the past. I know Ron Kirk, our U.S. trade representative, has a very good dialogue with him. His general counsel used to work for Sandy. So I think you'll find that we will have a constructive dialogue with him. We may or may not always agree on everything, but you can be sure that we will take his views fully into account. Obviously, we do, A, because he's very thoughtful and knowledgeable, and B, being chairman of the Ways and Means Committee now, we need to work with him on these issues.
Let's go to Marco. He's calling us from Worcester, Massachusetts. Marco, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my question is, how do I find manufacturers to manufacture my products than in the United States easier than trying to find manufacturers in China?
Uh-huh. And do you manufacture something in China now?
Not at the moment. I'm looking at prices at the moment.
Mm-hmm. So you have an idea for a product, and you think you might manufacture it in the United States and you might manufacture it in China?
Actually, I'd like to have it today made in America.
Uh-huh. And what have you found? Have you found there are differences when you look at where you might possibly manufacture this?
Well, the gentleman there said that they pay the Chinese a lot less. I guess he said 8 cents an hour or something, but they charge. Their prices are outrageous, and their metal isn't as strong as the United States metal. So,
all right, Marco. Marco, thanks very much for your call.
Well, this is interesting. I mean, I think, you know, one of the reasons American companies still manufacture a lot in the U.S., and we shouldn't forget that there's still a very robust manufacturing sector in the U.S., and it is undergoing major changes in productivity and improvements in productivity, is that American workers are very, very skilled and very competitive. And also, you have the shipping cost of making something in China and shipping it here. And a lot of Americans do look for, as this gentleman's indicated, a Made in America label. So we certainly, if this gentleman can make products competitively in this country, that's a very positive thing. We want to encourage the American manufacturing sector and do all we can. I meet with them very regularly, a lot of manufacturing companies. And we shouldn't sell this industry short. This industry is maybe employing fewer people, but it's not a dying industry at all. We can make a lot of things and make them very productively. And we should not forget that our trade exports and our trade balance, by and large, our trade balance over the last year and a half has improved very substantially. We're very competitive in certain manufacturing products, information communications technology, for instance, pharmaceuticals, agricultural goods, not a manufacturing sector, but we're very competitive. The service industry, we shouldn't forget, that employs a lot of people too. So we'd like to support manufacturing, agriculture, and services, and believe that they're very helpful in creating a lot of jobs in this country.
We're talking about trying to help American industries, but here's an email from Sean, who's in Ontario, Canada, and he writes, from the perspective of an outsider, both the president and the secretary of state took a highly protectionist stance as they campaigned to be their party's candidate in the last election. One of the president's earliest actions was to sign into law the federal Buy American Act, which imposes limits on foreign access to U.S. markets when federal funding is involved. And he writes, Canada did not retaliate in kind to the Buy America Act. But what about other nations that have trade agreements with the U.S.? Does the president's initiative include anything that diminishes the perception of U.S. protectionism?
Well, first of all, as the president indicated just very recently in the speech he gave that announced this National Export Initiative, that he did believe in free trade because he believes we need a very competitive environment internationally in order to sell our goods. The point that this gentleman is referring to is one particular part that was related to the overall effort to strengthen our financial system, and there was a provision in there with respect to government procurement. But the president also announced that this would be consistent with our international obligations under the WTO, and we have endeavored to make sure that we are adhering to the commitments of the WTO.
Daniel's been very patient. Daniel, thanks for holding on. He's calling us from Linville, North Carolina.
Yes, I'm a small business owner in North Carolina, and my question is, the international companies that produce goods that compete with us enjoy a lot less restriction from the government and you know, in terms of workers' rights and having to carry insurance on their workers. I think the U.S. government and the insurance companies have made this country one of the most expensive places in the world to produce goods. And, you know, how are we supposed to compete and what's being done to, you know, reduce the cost of producing a good here?
Daniel, before you go, what kind of product do you make?
I own a service business. It's a tree service business.
But so you're not involved in exports with that?
I'm not, no.
Yeah. All right, Daniel, thanks very much.
My costs are very high in terms of keeping labor and such.
Sure, right. Daniel, thanks very much.
Well, I it's hard for me to comment on the domestic tax system because that's really not in my area, but let me just make a couple of points relating to what the caller mentioned. It is certainly true that when he mentioned issues relating to labor standards and environmental standards and such things, those are very important. And if you look at our trade agreements, our goal in these trade agreements is to have very clear provisions with respect to foreign practices. These are the free trade areas, foreign practices in the environmental area and in labor standards. This is something environmentalists and the unions have made a very strong point about. And, we discussed Chairman Levin a little while ago. He has emphasized these also. So we're very clear that when we negotiate trade agreements, we want strong provisions so that countries will adhere to, for instance, protection of rights of workers and also deal with environmental issues in a constructive way. We want those to be in these trade agreements because we don't want countries to get a comparative advantage by having lax labor practices and lax environmental practices, which are harmful to the environment, to their workers, but also give them a comparative advantage vis-a-vis the United States. And let me also say that one of the key points that we in the State Department are focusing on, indeed our colleagues throughout the government, is we want to be sure that when we deal with other countries, we keep in mind the importance of relating to the interests of Americans on Main Street, American companies, American workers, American agriculture. We want to make sure that what we do internationally, whether it's trade agreements or other things, has a benefit for Americans at home. That is critically important. If we can do that, we can strengthen support for our international economic policy. But we are very much in this president's National Export Initiative and a number of other things we do. We and the federal government and all agencies, and certainly the State Department, are focused on the impact of what we do on Americans who are struggling these days. There's a high rate of unemployment. A number of people have lost money in the stock market. People are uncertain about their futures. We're bearing this very much in mind in the way we conduct international economic policy to make sure that it relates to those concerns and gives people the opportunities they deserve to compete fairly and effectively in the global economic system.
You know, you mentioned some of the problems with intellectual property rights in China. Here's an email from Ed, who writes us, "When I hear the presidents and others discuss the opportunity to export American manufactured goods to China, India, and other developing nations, I am struck by the obvious naivete. After 20 years of trying, I found it virtually impossible to sell American medical devices in China and do so at a profit. If you can get a toehold in the market, you do so at a dramatically discounted price that threatens the profitability of the operation. With market acceptance, your product will be copied by local Chinese manufacturers and sold to end users at a fraction of the U.S. goods price, regardless of your intellectual property rights. I've had this last scenario happen to me on multiple occasions. In one instance, having my product copied in less than 6 weeks from the time of the first sale in China."
Well, as I mentioned earlier on, that copyright protection issue is an enormous problem. There's no question that we as a government are focusing on this in China and other countries. This is not limited only to China, although, as this person has pointed out, it is certainly an issue in China. This is very important to us, and we're working with the Chinese to try to correct this. And this, when we talk to the Chinese at virtually every level, we raise this point. The broader question of selling in China, it is certainly difficult for some companies to sell in China, but a number of other American companies are doing quite well in the China market. And not all companies necessarily do well in any given market, but my instinct is that with respect to your products, and I sympathize with your problem, believe me, because you're among many who express these kinds of frustrations. But I would say that if you can, the American Embassy, the Department of Commerce, the U.S. Trade Representative's Office, the Small Business Administration, and the State Department here in Washington, we're all available to you, and the president has established as part of this initiative what he would call sort of one-stop shopping. There is a group of various agencies that is going to be available, and the Commerce Department is going to take the lead on this to help you in selling to foreign markets, and I urge you to avail yourself of that opportunity. The Department of Commerce also has in various parts of the country offices that are available to. So I would encourage you to call them. They're ready to help you. It may be that kind of assistance that you need, that they provide, can be very helpful to you in dealing with the kind of problem you face in China.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Reeb Show. You know, we've talked about some of the big issues that hurt American exports, like trade discrimination or the cost of labor. But Howard from Washington, D.C. has written us about another problem he's had. He writes, "I'm a small business person, a bookseller, and I used to export about $10,000 worth of books per year. Over a year ago, the Postal Service eliminated its surface rail rate, effectively tripling rates everywhere except to Canada and Mexico. And as a result, my exports have dropped about 75%. Often shipping costs are higher than the worth of my product. Bring back economical, if slow, surface mail, and my exports will soar." It kind of goes to I'm sure the post office thought it was making a smart decision by limiting surface mail, but it's had this terrible consequence for Howard.
Yes, I understand this. I mean, I'm not familiar with that problem, but I can understand anything that raises his costs make it more difficult for him to compete. I don't quite know what kind of advice to give him, except talk to the post office and see if there is some way of addressing your problem. But I will look into this, and it does strike me as an important issue. And his company, Howard's companies, are exactly the kind of company that we would like to help, because, you know, it's $10,000, but every $10,000 mounts up, and that means jobs and profits for his small company. So I will I'll take this down and see if there's some way of addressing this. I'm not an expert in the rates of the postal system, but I certainly understand his problem, that he wants to compete, and this makes it more difficult for him to compete. So, and we want to help just the kind of company that he represents.
Robert Hormats is Undersecretary of State for Economic, Energy, and Agricultural Affairs, a key figure in the export promotion initiative that President Obama announced last week. Thank you so much for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back on Wednesday. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.